Oh, welcome back to the second hour of On Democracy's Edge, only on News Radio AM 1450 KMMS in Bozeman. My name's Dead Rock Dave.
And I am Lady Di on Democracy's Edge, the club where every member is a VIP and no one gets left holding the golf bag. Join us, the Feral Cats of Freedom, as each week we cough up hairballs of truth. You heard me, hairballs of truth from the baloney that we've digested throughout the week from the Fat Cat News, the corpulent corporate news. Yes, hairballs can be messy, and the truth is sometimes messy, but it cleans out the system, and that's what our system needs. So here to help us clear a path through the brambles of deceit and deception and fear is Stephen Kinzer. He's an award-winning, and you know how oftentimes we say award-winning? Well, he actually did win an award. It was Columbia University awarded Stephen Kinzer. It's Maria Moore's Cabot Prize for Outstanding Coverage of Latin America. Anyway, award-winning foreign correspondent who has covered more than 50 countries on five continents, most of it for the New York Times. His foreign postings place him at the center of many historical events. Kinzer's most recent book is Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. It recounts the 14 times, yes, 14 times, folks, the United States has overthrown foreign governments. In 2003, Kinzer published All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. It tells how the CIA overthrew Iran's nationalist government in 1953. From 1983 to 1989, Kinzer was the Times Bureau chief in Nicaragua. In that post, he covered the war and upheaval in Central America. He also wrote two books about the region. One of them, co-authored with Stephen Schlesinger, is Bitter Fruit, The Untold Story of the American Coup in Guatemala. The Washington Post reviewer of Overthrow said, 20 years ago, Bitter Fruit motivated a whole generation to think seriously about the impact of U.S. interventions in the Southern Hemisphere. I have a sad suspicion that with Iraq's seemingly endless toll, Overthrow will likewise become required reading. From 1990 to 1996, Kinzer was posted in Germany covering the emergence of post-communist Europe, including the wars in former Yugoslavia. And he keeps on going, everybody, like the Energizer Bunny. In 1996, Kinzer was named chief of the New York Times Bureau in Istanbul, Turkey, one of my favorite cities. He spent 4 years there traveling widely in Turkey and in the new nations of Central Asia and the Caucasus, which, of course, will become very, very, very big and very important. After completing this assignment, he published Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds. Kinzer studied history at Boston U and now teaches journalism and political science at Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois, where Dave and Di come from, and contributes articles to the New York Review of Books, I love it, and other periodicals. His next book, of course, on Rwanda will be published soon. His articles and books have led the Washington Post to place him among the best in popular foreign policy storytelling. A big wow and welcome to Stephen. Stephen, this is Diane.
Yes.
Hi. Did you hear any of your introduction?
No, but I hope it was all good.
it's wonderful.
Yes, and someday I will tell you all about it. I read your whole bio for everybody and all the books that you have written over the years.
Yeah.
Did you start in 19? It says you wrote Bitter Fruit in what was that? 1980.
Early 80s.
And was that one of your first assignments to go to Nicaragua as a reporter, as a journalist?
Central America was the place that I started out, partly because even then, when I was just beginning my journalistic career, I was looking for essentially the same thing I'm still looking for, and that is untold stories. I'm always looking for stories that are really big and important, but nobody knows about them for whatever reason. So that's how I started in Central America, and if there's one thread that runs all the way through my books, that might be it.
Well, you're perfect for our show because we all also call ourselves the Border Collies of Sanity, and we try to round up the strays that got away from everybody else, those stray news items that are really big and important. And I think Central America, I do want to get to Iran, but I think, and I wondered if you thought that Central America and South America are going to be the big stories in the coming years.
Really, it's amazing what the leftist or nationalist movements in Latin America have been able to get away with in this last decade or so, particularly in the last few years. Latin America is building a more ever stronger coalition of countries and governments and nations that seem very much unwilling to do anything the United States wants. And actually, my friends down there in Latin America have convinced me that maybe there actually was one good outcome of the Iraq War. For them, they say, we would never have been allowed to get away with all of this.
Ah.
America hadn't been tied down over there. And one of them actually said, you know, we Latin Americans should vote for McCain because, or root for McCain because he wants to keep you guys in Iraq for 100 years, and that would be great for us.
Can finally take care of our own business without interference from El Norte,
Wow. I was thinking of that when I was thinking about your book. And by the way, I don't want to get real, I told the people here, don't want to get really Kathy Bates on you, you know, Kathy Bates in Misery. But you're the kind, I would like to, like, keep you for a whole week and talk to you about, but not in a cabin somewhere. Just on the phone would be fine.
Well,
but
how about in a cabin, like in a studio?
Yeah. For a whole week, I think everything that you've written, I'm so interested about, and I see all these connections. Now, your latest book, Overthrow, talks about the 14 times we've been so kind as to change regimes for people. What was our first attempt? What was that?
Well, I take it all the way back to the American assisted overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii back in the 1890s. You know, I got off on this tangent, this interest in American regime change operations, way back when I wrote that book you mentioned earlier, the one about how the U.S. overthrew the government of Guatemala in the early 50s. I wrote a book about that. Later on, I wrote a book about how the U.S. overthrew the government of Iran, also in the 50s. And I've written about American intervention like this in Nicaragua. So each time I wrote one of these books, I felt kind of satisfied, like I'd really ripped away the veil of lies and I told the whole truth about what really happened down there. But after a while, as often happens when you get a little satisfied with yourself, I realized that, you know, I'd missed actually a big part of the story, and that's this. As long as you consider these American interventions and these American overthrows of foreign governments as separate, unrelated incidents that just happen periodically, you're missing a very important part of the story. Hmm. You really need to study them, and that's what I do in my new book, as a continuum that stretches over more than 100 years. And when you do that, as I did in this overthrow book, you really begin to tease out the patterns that recur time and time again in these American interventions.
And so, is it what kind of patterns are there? Like, we want like to steal people's stuff?
Well, I'll tell you a couple of the patterns. I think, you know, actually, that is reduced right down to the essential. One of the fundamental reasons why big and powerful countries have always attacked poor and weak ones. The strong one wants something, and the poor one has it, and he can't protect it. Now, here are a couple of patterns that I see recurring time and time again in American interventions. First of all is the reason why we do it. Not all of them fit this pattern, but most of them do. I find a three-part pattern. So the first thing that happens in almost all these cases is that the government of country X starts to bother some big foreign company, usually an American company. And the government there is trying either to regulate or restrict or tax or nationalize or subject to national laws or in other ways harass some big American company. And the head of that company then goes to Washington to complain. That's the first stage. Usually, if there's no conflict with an American company, then Country X doesn't even come onto the radar screen in Washington. It really doesn't matter what they do if they're not bothering some big American economic interest. But phase two comes when inside the American foreign policy process, inside the White House, if you will, the motivation morphs, it changes. The people in the White House or in the State Department change their idea of the motivation from an economic one to a political or a geostrategic one. They decide that country X is actually an enemy of the United States. And how do they know this? It's because that government is bothering or harassing or taxing or regulating some American company, which must mean that this government is anti-American and anti-capitalist and probably in league with all of our global enemies. So although the economic motive is what puts it on the radar screen in the first place, we intervene with this idea that we're doing it for political reasons. Mm. And then the third stage comes when it's time for our American leaders to explain, why did we do it to our people or to the world? And then you get this third motivation that didn't even come up in the earlier stages, and that is, we only did it to help them. We just wanted to liberate people that were being brutally oppressed by an evil dictator. And this plays really well with Americans because on the one hand, we're very compassionate people, and on the other hand, we're also very ignorant about the outside world. And so we love hearing that we didn't go over to any country to get anything for ourselves. On the contrary, we sacrificed to help those poor people. That plays well in America.
It's exactly. I mean, it seems one of the biggest myths that people don't understand about the Iraq War is the corporate involvement and the economic takeover.
Well, I sometimes marvel at this sort of closed circle of, like, the half of the giant corporations are making money by being paid to destroy things when we invade these countries, and the other half are being paid to rebuild them after we destroy them.
Yeah. Are you friends with Naomi Klein? I love Naomi Klein, but I love the Shah.
Same mailing list.
Okay. So you wrote all the Shah's Men, and by the way, it's a very popular book in my little town of 1,500 people, Big Timber, Montana. When I heard about this like over a year ago, somebody trying to tell me that you've got to read this book, All the Shah's Men. Anyway, it's been being passed around, and I haven't been able to get my hands on it yet because somebody else still has it. But in All the Shah's Men, that's the overthrow of Mossadegh in 1952 or 53. What kind of stuff were we interested in stealing there?
Very simply, the case of the overthrow of the democratic government of Iran in 1953 was the first time the CIA had ever overthrown a foreign government. What happened was that a British company owned the entire Iranian oil industry as part of a corrupt deal they had struck with some Iranian functionaries early in the century. And in the 1950s, as nationalism began to grow in Iran, there became a big movement in Iran. We got to take back control of the oil that's under our soil, all the profits of which were going to England. So this nationalist movement propelled Mohammad Mossadegh to power. He implemented the nationalization of Iranian oil industry. That drove the British crazy. They tried to overthrow him, but Mossadegh found out what they were doing and cracked down on them. And then later on, after Eisenhower and Secretary of State John Foster Dulles came to power, the British got the Americans to do this for them. So we went into Iran in 1953 and overthrew not just the one leader, but the entire democratic system in Iran, which has never returned. If we had managed to keep our hands off Iran and had just been patient and allowed the political processes in Iran to proceed at their own pace, we might have had a thriving democracy in the heart of the Muslim Middle East all these last 50 years. And I can hardly wrap my mind around how different the world might look had that been the case.
It continues to boggle my mind. Was this how they sold it to people because it was another anti-communist because right after World War II, we were worried about Stalin?
Exactly. And the other pattern here that emerges, which Iran is a great example, is the difference in how these coups look right after you carry them out and then how they look a long time later. So we overthrew Mossadegh in 1953. That was great. It seemed like everything worked for us. We got rid of a guy we didn't like, and we replaced him with another guy, the Shah, who would do everything we wanted. So that was perfect. But let's look back now and see what happened. The Shah ruled with increasing repression for 25 years. His repression produced the Islamic Revolution of the late 1970s, which brought to power this fanatically anti-American clique of mullahs who have been working for the last 30 years to undermine Western influence all over the world. That weakness that shook Iran during that revolution also inspired Iran's biggest enemy, next door, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, to invade Iran. And that in turn led the U.S. to form a military alliance with Saddam, because we were so angry at Iran. We helped Saddam get U.S. helicopters that he used to drop poison gas inside Iraq, and we helped his Air Force target Iranian units. So that started our death embrace with Saddam that led us into our current Iraq quagmire. And the Iranian Revolution also spooked the Soviets. They were terrified that there might be other copycat Islamic fundamentalist revolutions all along their southern flank. That led them to invade Afghanistan. That, in turn, is what led the U.S. to start its big jihadi program, to start training all these tens of thousands of Muslim warriors to go kill the infidel. Those Muslim warriors that we trained later became the Taliban, and the infidel they wanted to kill became us. So all of this history came from a few weeks of U.S. intervention in Iran way back in the 1950s. It's an object lesson of how impossible it is to control the long-term effects of these interventions.
So it's short-sighted and long-sighted. The short sight, we continue to have these not put the right glasses on, and then we pay for it.
Years beware later. Of that first domino that you're toppling, because you don't know where it's going to lead down the road. Obviously, I mean, this is like a reverse domino theory that we were told that we had when the communists were going to come at us.
What is the CIA? I mean, I don't get the CIA. We both read Legacy of Ashes, and we had Melvin Goodman on, who was an analyst, not one of the spooks. It's a little secret army of the presidents, right, that we don't know about?
Let me give you my take on the CIA that I developed during the course of researching Overthrow. I'm going to tell you, make two observations. First of all, I really do believe that the notion I kind of grew up believing of the rogue elephant CIA is wrong.
Okay.
That the CIA is acting strictly under the orders of the president, the president's designated authority.
That's what Melvin said.
I don't see it as being blameworthy. If you don't like what the CIA is doing, don't blame the CIA. They're doing what they're told to do. Now, here's another fact that I discovered while writing this book, Overthrow, and I don't think anybody has ever noticed this before, because you would have had to study all four of the CIA overthrows together, which I don't think anyone else has done up until I wrote my book. So the CIA overthrew the governments of, they intervened in many countries, of course, but they overthrew the governments of four countries. Iran in 1953, Guatemala in 1954, South Vietnam in 1963, and then Chile in 1973. In the course of my research, I discovered that in all four of these cases, the CIA station chief was against the coup. In all four cases, the guy we paid to be our number one expert on that country was sending notes back to Washington saying, don't do this. This is not going to work. This is not going to be good for us. And fired.
This is a page-turner.
Yeah, Stephen, we're up against a break. Can you stay with us after the short break?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. You are listening to News Radio KMMS 1450 AM. We'll be right back with Stephen Kinzer.
High and dry in the long, hot day. Lost and lonely every way.
I want a girl with a mind.
All right. Welcome back to News Radio AM 1450's KMMS's Democracy's Edge. I'm Dead Rock Dave.
And I am Lady Di here on Democracy's Edge. And we are talking to Stephen Kinzer, our award-winning foreign correspondent, who's covered more than 50 countries on five continents. And his most recent book is Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. It recounts the 14 times the United States has overthrown foreign governments. We were talking about his book, All the Shah's Men, which another great book, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror, and his book, another great book, Bitter Fruit, The Untold Story of the American Coup in Guatemala. But let's go back to the patterns, because we are very concerned here, and we talk about this every week on Democracy's Edge. We try to connect the dots, and few people try to do that, and it sounds like, Stephen, you did that with Overthrow.
Well, you know, you're very right that people don't really try to understand about what's behind events. And I blame the press a lot for that. That's one reason why I finally
quit,
left the New York Times, and I broke out of that prison of objectivity. I can now admit that I'm not interested in news. I feel that news is the enemy of information. If you're so focused on what happened today and what happened yesterday, and the whole paper is full of that, then there's no room for why all this happened, what's behind it, what ties it together, and what's going to happen in the future if we keep doing what we're doing now.
Right.
So news is actually a great tool to keep people ignorant. Oh. I like to take my motto from a line in the Declaration of Independence where it says, let facts be submitted to a candid world. Now, I don't consider myself an ideologue or a polemicist. All I'm asking is that we reflect on the facts of what has happened, and let's consider our interests coldly, not emotionally. It's okay for America to act in America's interests, but let's sit down and think what really is in our interest over the long run, and not do things that make us feel good in the short run, but in the long run wind up undermining our own security and the stability of the world.
Wow. Mm. I'm wrapping my head around that. We were talking about the connections between the four coups the overthrows that you mentioned that we really took a strong part in, right? When we...
And that the station chiefs for the CIA were telling the people back in Washington not to do this. What is it? I guess my question would be, why do people in Washington not listen to people on the ground?
I think it's because we've decided on the basis of emotion what should be our policy toward a country. And when you're too much of an expert on what's really happening in that country, you're not guided by emotion. Now, let me tell you a little experience that just happened to me in the last week that makes me realize kind of a shift, I think, in American attitudes towards intervention, possibly as a result of the Iraq debacle. So last weekend, I was in Washington, D.C., and I spoke at a conference of libertarians. The guy speaking with me on the platform was Ron Paul, and the people there believe that they're so far right that they don't want federal income tax and they want to abolish the Federal Reserve Bank. So then I got home the next day and I see an email and I'm being invited by the Progressive Democrats of America, who are so far left, they're opposing John Kerry in Massachusetts because he refuses to filibuster against the Iraq War funding. And they want me to speak about anti-intervention. So I'm realizing by the fact of these two episodes that the division in American politics between sort of the more neo-interventionist and the more rational is not so much a left-right division anymore or a Democrat-Republican division. It's more of a division between people that are driven by visionary utopian emotions on the one hand and people that are just coldly considering realpolitik on the other side. So I feel that what I'm advocating is actually just a really very conservative policy of coolly assessing what's in our national interest. And Iran is the perfect example of a country where we're reacting with total emotion. We're still angry at them for taking our hostages in 1979 and taking away our Shah. And our anger about this has blinded us to what's actually in our own interest, which would be a new relationship with Iran. So we are too often allowing emotions to shape our foreign policy, and that's why we're being outmaneuvered by other countries that are guided more by their own interests.
Wow, that's amazing to think of it. Just this ideologue, we keep getting people in Washington who see the world as they want to see it instead of, like he said, looking at it coolly. How are we going to get rid of these people? How do you know that you're getting someone who's looking at things practically?
Well, you can never know, of course. One of my colleagues, Seymour Hersh, sometimes gets this question. He told me when during his speeches that after he gives his speech about how America is losing its civil liberties and the whole world is turning against us and we're following all these blind interventionist dead ends and so forth, someone will always get up in the audience and say, oh, you're so right. Ah, man, it was great. And, you know, I agree with you. So what can we do about this? What can we do to stop this? And I heard something. I love to look down in the microphone and just say, nothing. But I don't like to do that. I do believe that maybe as a result of the Iraq War, at least temporarily, there is less willingness in the gut of the American people to immediately go off on support of these foreign ventures. You know, we have this can-do mentality in America, which is great and, you know, really helps build what America is. We have the sense that we can overcome all obstacles. And when you have an obstacle that's posed by nature or by technology or by other people, really wanting it a lot and working hard and being determined can make the difference. But the can-do mentality also can be dangerous because it makes you believe that even when you're dealing with obstacles that are posed by cultures and distances of time and space, just wanting to do it a lot and really working hard at it is going to get it done. That doesn't always work. And I think maybe Americans are starting to realize that we haven't mastered history yet, that there are some other processes still underway out there in the world that we don't control.
You're just getting your arm around or your head around that. Like I could say, it's.
So, can we? You're talking about can we change this pattern that of just Americanism? I mean, are Americans naturally? Teddy Roosevelt once said that we were naturally expansionists. That's what we are as Americans. We just want more room. And we keep moving and expanding. Is it? Are we finally figuring out, or is it that we don't have enough people telling us that we should? Why not we just like be comfortable and kind of hunker down and be content with where we are? Is that un-American?
This has been a long debate in American history. You know, when John Winthrop first arrived here and became the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, he made that speech where he said, "We shall be as a city upon a hill, and the eyes of all people are upon us." Now, what he meant, as he wrote in other explanations, was that what the U.S. should do, what this new land should do, would be to build a great country and a great society, and then, if we did a good job and we were happy and prosperous and successful, then our example would be such that maybe some people in other countries would want to copy us, or at least some aspects of what we've done. But at some point in the 19th century, we moved from that, from the idea that we should just be an example to the world, into this idea that we should go out and campaign in the world and turn the world into our domain. A lot of this was driven by the fact that by the end of the 19th century, the U.S. was going through lots of economic problems. There were depressions, there were bank crashes, there were boom and bust, there was industrial rebellion, and some people thought we were on the verge of revolution. We needed new markets for our products. We were producing more in our fields and more in our factories than our people could possibly consume. So we needed to expand. expand, and in order to expand, we had to have governments in foreign countries that would allow us to expand. That's what we call the open door policy, which I sometimes like to call the kick in the door policy. We forced these other countries to adopt regimes that would allow us to expand economically. And then when there would be rebellions in those countries, we'd have to support the regime there in putting down these rebellions. And that went on and on through the 20th
century. So it's because we've always been making too much stuff. So we overproduce and we have to find somewhere to sell it. But now we're not producing anything.
I'm actually thinking that in the future, with the resource competition between growing powers like India and China and Russia, along with the existing consumers like the U.S. and Europe, maybe we will get to a point where we realize that intense competition over who's going to get how much cobalt out of the Congo is not good for anybody. And maybe we need to manage this competition in a way that is going to bring all the consuming and the producing countries together into some kind of a balance. Maybe that would be something that we would like the next president to take on as kind of a long-term project. Because competition for scarce resources with a growing population that's richer all over the world is going to be a dominant fact of life in the 21st century.
So we know we have a pretty good idea. Maybe your Latin American friends can tell us if John McCain is elected president, then they're in good shape because we're going to stay over in the Middle East. But are they a little fearful that President Obama might attack Venezuela?
Well, I think the Venezuelan situation is a great example of how if you just keep your hands off. Over the long run, you're going to get the result you want. You know, Venezuelans are not stupid. They're going to have their own politics. Maybe they'll do things we don't like. We do things they don't like. That's fine. But in the end, let the Venezuelans work it out. They are not threatening the existence of the United States. We might not like them, but we don't need to like everybody. They don't like us either.
Oh, that's so great. We don't need to like everybody, do we? It's like, I'm not okay, you're not okay, and that's okay.
I want to make that a T-shirt. That's
yeah.
a great slogan.
Yeah.
Hey, Stephen, we got a phone call on here. Would you like to take a question from
one
of our callers?
Okay, let's do one last one. Great.
Okay. Caller, you are on the air with Stephen Kinter. Do you have a question?
Oh, yes. I'm totally honored. It's such an amazing person to have on your show and author of so many interesting books. I wanted to ask, everything comes back to, in all Mr. Kinzer's points and everything, is basically about capitalism and that this country is really not really to democracy as, you know, its ideology is capitalism. And is there reason to hope when capitalism always, you know, is controlling these movements to take other countries' resources and the propaganda machine of the media control the American public and basically, our economic system really prevents us from creating a sustainable country that stays within our borders. So,
are you running for president?
next lifetime.
Okay. Well, let me say that I think that was a very trenchant comment. There's no doubt that The waves of American expansion overseas have been largely driven by economic interest and economic selfishness. It's also true that when weapons manufacturers in the U.S. produce some very expensive new system, they always arrange to make sure that every state is producing at least one piece of this giant machine, so that if there's ever a move in Congress to cut that wasteful expenditure, all the senators in Congress and all over America will be protesting. Also, the effect that corporate contributions have into American politics really does underline what your caller was talking about. Now, I've lived abroad much of my adult life, and one thing I do notice in comparing the democracy in the U.S. with the democracy in other Western countries, such as the ones in Europe, is that the role of private money and the role of lobbyists in the capital city is way out of proportion in the U.S. to what you're going to find in any other country. So these really are disturbing symptoms, along with the corporate control of the media that the caller also mentioned, as we try to develop some kind of counter-narrative and imagine how we can pull ourselves away from this economic-driven expansionism.
Go ahead, Betsy.
At least in the historical continuum, we're about not even at the fall of Rome in American history. You know, we're like, we're not at 313. And so we have a lot to learn, and the Europeans have sort of built their social democracy. And we just haven't gotten there yet. And,
I think one of the odd things about this group that's in power now is that you've got some people who are in powerful positions in Washington who truly believe that history has stopped happening, that the United States has now gotten to a point of so much greater power than any other country ever had before, that the lessons of the past just don't apply to us anymore. There's no point in trying to look back and see what happened to past great powers or empires, because those situations are totally not comparable to what we have. So history has no lesson for us anymore. You know, I used to think it was terrible when people didn't draw the right lessons. Now you have a group of people saying there is no such thing as a lesson from history for us.
Isn't that great Susskind quote that the White House operative said, we're creating our own history, and all you people will just do is sit around and write it down. But we create our own reality.
It reminds me of a great line I remember reading in Russell Baker's autobiography, why he decided that he wanted to quit being a Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. He said, I finally realized that most of my working hours were spent sitting outside a locked door on Capitol Hill waiting for someone to come out and lie to me.
Oh, it sounds like our national media we get every Sunday morning.
Yeah, and that's when you said that you quit the press. Quit the press. But you felt that you were somewhat in a prison of some kind? You didn't feel free?
I didn't really quit the press. I'm still working. I write articles for the New York Review of Books where I just...
Well, I love that.
Nicaragua, and I've got a piece coming out in the Smithsonian Magazine. So, yeah, I'm writing, but I don't work for the daily press anymore. And part of the reason for that is that as we were in the run-up to the Iraq War, I really wanted to speak out, having been a person that had covered Iraq and had an opinion about Iraq, and I saw us going in a very dangerous direction. But being a newspaper reporter on the staff of the New York Times at that time, I wasn't able to get up and bang my spoon on the high chair. That compromises my objectivity. And I found that very depressing, particularly as I watched the press, including the New York Times, participate in the drumbeat that led us off to war. So I thought to myself that I'd like to get myself in a position where if ever in the future there's another crisis between the U.S. and some country that I happen to know something about, I could participate, I could protest, I could make my own views public.
You mean you have an opinion?
That's one of the reasons I quit the New York Times and why I'm now speaking out about the Iran situation.
Well, yes, we want to probably conclude with that, because this is why we had you on, is this Iran situation, they're still beating this drum. Is there, and you and your colleagues... and we've had several on, and we will continue to do this. This is a very bad idea, right, to attack Iran?
As I learned in all my research about these overthrows, you can never control the long-term results. Now, we can guess what some of the results of an American bombing attack on Iran might be. First of all, of course, it would really strengthen the government. If you really want to help President Ahmadinejad, who's hugely unpopular now, so much so that he may not even run for re-election next year, you want to help him? Great. Invade his country. Bomb his country. In every country in the world, as we saw here after 9/11, people rally behind their leaders when they're attacked. So that's just a logical thing. That would happen automatically. You'd have huge reprisal attacks against Israel, against U.S. troops in Iraq, which is right on Iran's border, and in Afghanistan, which is right on Iran's border. Probably the Strait of Hormuz could be closed. That's where 20% of the world's oil is coming through. You'd see terrorist attacks maybe in many other parts of the world. And those are just some of the effects that we could predict.
Now,
undoubtedly, there would be many other unpredictable ones.
It sure wouldn't help the price of gas, would it?
Yeah, but it goes beyond
I
that.
Know, but, you know, a lot of our listeners are worried about the price
certainly.
Of gas.
If you're the only thing people... now, try 50% higher.
We try to be very, very esoteric here and historical, but, boy, by and large, the people around here, they
Americans don't notice anything until it's at the pump.
Well, considering how deeply we're involved in the Middle East, I think it's going to be at the pump for quite a while.
I would think so. Well, this policy we've done over there certainly doesn't seem to be working now.
Can I ask you a question I always ask? When you went to Boston as a history major.
I was, yes.
And what made you want to become a writer or a correspondent? Did someone encourage you to be a writer, or did you... how did you make the transition from history major to foreign correspondent?
I don't consider that to be any transition at all.
Uh-huh.
As a foreign correspondent, I used to think to myself, I'm sitting in the front row of the arena while history is unfolding in the arena right in front of me. And I'm watching history unfold, and I'm writing it, and I'm transmitting what is essentially the first draft of history back to my newspaper or my editor. I don't think that history only comprises what's happened in the past. History is what's unfolding right now, and being a foreign correspondent is the only way that you can watch history as it is unfolding now. So I don't see that was a transition. In fact, I think the history study really prepared me for this fascinating.
Well, I'm always trying to ask these questions for hopefully younger listeners on radio when they're trying to make decisions as to what they, you know, they want to do. Obviously, you're teaching now at Northwestern. Journalism?
I teach journalism and political science, and what I like to leave my students with is the message that one of the greatest things you can do in life is to spend some time with people that have had very different lives from yours. That's the way you really begin to open up your mind and understand the rest of the world. This is a big problem for America. You know, Americans are so different from the people in all the other countries in the world. In most other countries, people think of themselves as citizens of one country in a whole globe full of countries. You know, we're in one country, there's another country over here, another country over there. The U.S. doesn't believe that. Americans tend to think that the whole world is divided between two groups of countries, and one group is the United States, and the other group is all the other countries in the world, which are populated by people that are very unhappy because they don't have the only thing that's worth having in the world, which is the chance to be American. There's no one else in the world that looks at humanity this way. And it makes me think back to that line from the old Scottish poet Robert Burns, who wrote in Old English, "Oh, that some God the gift he gee us to see ourselves as others see us."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, geez, thank you. We are just about out of time here. We only have a minute, and we wanted to thank you very, very much for coming on our little radio show out here in Montana.
We are very privileged to have you on, and but I probably will try and capture you again.
Well, keep coughing up those fur balls.
I will. We'll definitely be trying to cough up the hairballs of truth and try to round up some of these stray stories from other countries and other peoples that get away from most of the mainstream news.
Okay, keep it up.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you. And that was our interview with Stephen Kinzer. Wow. I mean, he's been all over. I like what he said about being there and looking at history. It's so much different than the news we're getting from these, I don't know what the word's for, I guess the fat cats will go it, who basically seem to just be sitting on their butts there in Washington or in some radio studio somewhere and not seeing things, but telling you how it exactly is.
Right. And you know, just in some sort of la-la land,
mm-hmm.
reporting okay. about whatever.
Whatever they think the world should be. You've been listening to Democracy's Edge, only on News Radio AM 1450 KMMS, and we'll be back with our third hour after the news.